Okay, let's start the show.
It's March 28th, 2013. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. I'm Will Smith. Joining me today, Norman Chan.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
We went to GDC this morning.
We did, and we just got back. And
we just got back.
This is a rush cast with GDC fresh in mind. Hey, this Vader head on the table is really dirty. I dare you to put it on.
I'll put it on. Hand it over. It's also cracked.
It's cracked on the left side.
Yeah, I know. But is it dirty inside? It looks fine inside. Oh, it's a little dusty inside, but...
That is a good fit.
I think it sits right on top of the
headphones.
There you go. Yeah, there we go. This is...
Wow.
I feel kind of like Rick Moranis in here. It's very echoey.
It's a fetching look.
Do you have the rest of it?
I do not believe the rest of it would fit right now. I think it's better without the rest of it. Just the helmet.
It's a real dumb look. I've worn a lot of dumb stuff in my face today.
What was Rick Moranis' character's name in Spaceballs?
Dark Helmet. It was a much bigger helmet. Adam has one of those in his shop, too. It's up on the ceiling.
It's what much your bigger favorite helmet. Part of Spaceballs?
You know, Spaceballs is one of those movies that hasn't aged very well. Have you noticed?
It has aged perfectly.
No. Some Mel Brooks stuff ages pretty well, and some stuff not so much. Like Blazing Saddles has aged spectacularly.
We all know about your love for Blazing Saddles.
It is a favorite movie of mine. On the other hand, Spaceballs, a lot of it is very 80s-y in a kind of negative way.
Yes, from the music to
the Winnebago.
Yes.
To the Joan Rivers, who turns out to be timeless. But at the time, it's a very 80s Joan Rivers.
Wow, I forgot it was Joan Rivers as C-3PO.
And Daphne Zuniga of The Fly and Melrose Place is Princess Leia.
She never did anything.
Except for the thing that you just listed.
She never amounted to anything. She didn't become President of the United States.
But she's supposed to be
President. Bill Pullman.
Wait. Oh, yeah. Well, I always mix him up with Bill Paxton, who's in Aliens.
They are both Bills, and they're both in science fiction movies.
And they have a similar look.
They
could fill the same role.
I would not go so far as to say they have a similar look.
It sounds really weird in here. Have you worn this thing?
No, because it's dirty.
It echoes in a novel way.
Well, congratulations.
Favorite part of Spaceballs is probably the combing the desert joke. It's a really, really dumb joke. But then they have the giant comb, and that's pretty funny every time.
The favorite part of Spaceballs for me is the VHS tape, Spaceballs movie.
Oh, the queuing up. Yes.
Which I think is right before the combing the desert joke.
Yeah, it's or is it before or after?
I think it's right before, because they go to where are they?
Oh, that's how they figure out where they're
at. Right now, here.
Yeah, that's a real, it's like a pointer, the joke. Because it's a reference, they're showing what's happening now, right now. It's almost like the dumb stuff that we did on the green screen.
They couldn't, that must have been one of the last scenes they shot.
Because they had to do post on the ludicrous speed,
the ridiculous stuff, the embarrassing stuff that they fast-forwarded through in that scene.
Or they could have just talked about doing that and superimposed it. Because back then, remember, you couldn't shoot CRTs because they had frame rates. They had a refresh line. So when you shot a CRT, I think even with film,
the scan line would show, wouldn't it? I know with certain video cameras, that is definitely true.
I don't know if that's the case with film.
I do not know whether that they did composite that shot in, because I don't know. That would have been more expensive than that shot, than they could have done with that shot. They could have got away with.
Spaceballs didn't come out until the mid-80s. By that point, green screen technology was real cheap. Because by that point, the local weather station was doing it.
Anyone who worked on Spaceballs.
Yeah, we'd be interested. The thing that we don't remember, like when I was a little kid, real little kid, and you probably don't remember this, the weather station used to be like a person standing up in front of what was essentially like a chalkboard with some magnets and stuff on it.
Pre-green screen.
And they would move the little pieces around. Like the sun would move around.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
All I know is that the timing for the weathermen and women, the meteorologists, the timing is very, very important. They have a very limited time to do their segment. Yeah. The animations are all done in the green screen, and they basically have to write out their script and be perfect.
Yeah.
It is not an easy thing
to do. Well, they're watching cues. And also, from watching that Nick Cage movie, I understand that people throw food at weathermen, too.
That movie was called The Weatherman.
Because they blame the weatherman for the bad weather.
I don't know if that was the point of that movie.
Well, there was a lot of inappropriate humor in
yes,
there.
There was.
Relating
to animals of the desert.
I'm really glad that I'm not a weatherman. Gina doesn't like our local weatherman at all, our weather lady. The NBC one in the morning.
See, it all depends on which channel you watch also.
That's true. You're not an NBC guy.
No, I'm an ABC person.
Really? You're an ABC person?
Always ABC.
Good Morning America?
No, I don't.
Oh,
no.
Nightly News. I'm
talking about local.
You watch local news? I never watched local news.
I used
news.
To watch local news.
Oh, okay. Why did you watch ABC instead of NBC or CBS?
I like the color scheme better.
What was the color scheme?
Blue and silver of ABC. NBC had the...
It's always like peacocky.
Yeah, it was a little warmer colors.
You like the cold colors?
The colder colors are better.
Yeah. Interesting.
Seven was also a better number.
Seven is, but what was NBC then? Four?
Four.
Yeah, seven is a better number than four. We went to GDC this morning. Can I take this off now?
I guess if you want.
I mean,
it's disappointing.
I'm adding value,
thousands of people out there.
There are hundreds of people.
This is a practice of an exercise in not moving your head that much, of staying focused.
I already have to do that to talk into the microphone. Having to do more would be worse. So we went to GDC.
GDC, if you don't know, it's a game developers conference.
Yeah.
Every year, game developers from all over the world, game companies, game publishers, come to the Bay Area. And there are several other events, of course, in Austin and I believe Shanghai as well, to talk about making video games. And this is to educate other developers. It's a lot of networking goes on.
It's about growing the craft.
A lot of students and aspiring developers do recruiting there.
Mm-hmm.
Companies do recruiting there as well. And for consumers, though, it is also a place for some announcements. So in past years, GDC was, for example, the announcement of the first Xbox was at GDC.
Yes. Nintendo's announced a couple of games there, I think. Miyamoto had a talk one year that ended with a, oh, by the way, we're doing this thing.
And GDC happens in the spring, at least the Bay Area GDC.
Previously
in San Jose, now in San Francisco. And so it's kind of a way to get ahead of E3 announcements, a couple months away from E3 to kind of separate yourself out from the crowd. Well, so on live.
But also because of the time of year it is, if there's going to be a new console coming out in the fall, typically the games that people are going to be showing at GDC are going to be running on that new hardware. And so like the 360 dev kits, the first place we saw them was at GDC. As you said, OnLive debuted there.
OnLive and game companies can announce games at GDC with an event and then show more at E3 and then launch the game in the fall.
You know, the conference, though, has been trying to shy away from that. They realized that it got to be too big of a spectacle.
I don't think that they can.
This point, it's too late.
This year, the games that were announced, the big games that were announced were Battlefield 4.
Yeah.
And also the new Metal Gear Solid 5.
Yeah.
The Phantom Pain.
So, I hadn't played any Metal Gear Solid games until
I don't think either of us are equipped to talk Metal Gear lore or Metal Gear history.
All I was going to say is every time you and Joey start talking about that stuff, I kind of get more and more confused.
It is very confusing.
Yeah, it's like I played Metal Gear on the NES.
It is a Japanese Star Wars.
Really?
Paramilitary.
It's a dystopian future, right?
Yes.
So
near future.
I kind of want to go back and play the NES Metal Gear games because like at the time that they came out, I was 10 years old and I didn't know I think that was probably the first time I'd ever seen anything that required stealth at all. I wonder knowing how to, like, now I know how to play stealth games, right? And I wonder if that knowledge from modern stealth games would help going back and playing.
I think now you know how to play stealth games the way stealth games are designed today.
Well, that's the thing. That's the question.
I don't know. I don't know if they were actually designed. I don't think they were designed that way.
Did you play those games at all?
But Metal Gear Solid 1 was the first game I played in that series. I dabbled a little bit in Metal Gear.
So the NES games were all like top-down, kind of, you know, line-of-sight games, basically. Okay, so a couple of games that launched kind of don't care about that much.
The trailer looked good for Metal Gear Solid 5, and I know people are excited about that. There was a big launch event for Battlefield 4 last night.
Yeah, people were upset about it.
People were upset about it for a whole host of reasons, but I think primarily that they showed 17 minutes of single player when this is really a multiplayer game, and they really tried to pimp those pre-orders.
Did they talk about microtransactions? Because, you know, nope. All EA games have microtransactions now.
And, you know, really... recalled the Battlefield 3 announcement, except that was much more highly anticipated because there had been so much time between Battlefield 2 and 3.
Well, and there now, was a big graphics jump, too. I mean, yes, a huge graphics jump.
Correlated with the big difference in time. There was Bad Company 1 and 2 before Battlefield 3 came out. And Battlefield 4 just seems like they're now rushing Battlefield into a more frequent release cycle. And... you know, improving things where they can in the 2 years, 2-3 years between game launches. But it really looks at least from the 17-minute trailer, looks like the same game. You know, very cinematic, modern-day shooter.
A response to Call of Duty.
Yes.
So you and I both played a lot of early Battlefield games, the multiplayer-only Battlefield 1942.
I was 1942. I remember a time when DICE was making racing games, and I played 1942 at PC Gamer before it came out. I remember William Harms coming in and saying, this is the best game ever. Mm-hmm. And that game really took a lot of players from the Tribes community.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tribes was one of the first big, successful collaborative multiplayer.
Large-scale multiplayer team-based
games after Quake. And Battlefield was even larger scale, and plus the demo, the Wake Island demo, really sold a lot of people on that. Well, so,
it was one of those games that people played the demo for hundreds of hours before the game came out, and then they didn't stop because the map was so good.
The map was fantastic.
Yeah,
and you could do lots of emergent stuff in 1942 with the stunts, mm-hmm. Just turning friendly fire off, and Battlefield.
Battlefield 2 added the squad stuff, which was
all the expansions of 1942 were great.
Yeah.
Even the secret weapons of World War II.
It was a little late.
Battlefield 2 was amazing and wonderful and incredible and had squad stuff. And
The squad stuff made the kind of leveled up the team play options.
And Battlefield 3, and of course there are a lot of games in between that, Bad Company and all that stuff. Battlefield 3 was the StarCraft 2 to Battlefield 1. Battlefield 2.
The reimagining / modernization.
But it's how you remembered it in your head.
Oh, yeah. Well, except for the maps. I felt like the maps were a little bit smaller.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the Return of Kharkan pack.
Oh, yeah.
Once you had the actual maps, Gulf of Oman, Return of Kharkan, Strike at Kharkan, Wake Island, all that stuff.
Did you play a lot of BF3?
Yeah, absolutely. Not as much as Mike Horn, though. And I think they have 4 expansion packs now.
It seems
4 or 5.
I lost track.
And the last one, which they said was the final one, came out a month ago, which people really love. Motorcycles and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Oh, cool. So they showed a lot of single player. Did you play the single player campaign at all in BF3?
I played like 3 hours of it and got really, really bored and just didn't care so much.
I haven't played.
It was just time sucking up the time I could have been multiplayer.
Yeah, I didn't play either that or I played a lot of multiplayer. I didn't play any of the single player or any Call of Duty single player last year. So
the multiplayer still is fun in Battlefield 3 and it runs even better now. So it's one of those things, just like Call of Duty.
Is that because you have a better computer now, or because they've optimized?
Combination of both.
Okay.
But it feels like there's moving, you know, they're going to release this, charge $60, and then get people moving into the new game.
Well, it's the same old story. Yeah.
So the show floor, though, of GDC.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. Over the years, the show floor at GDC has changed. In the old days, it was a bunch of small booths, basically. Like there were small presences for the big game companies like EA and Activision and Microsoft and Sony,
and it was more about
Nintendo,
the middleware.
And yeah, and there were a lot of people selling things like weird controllers and weird interface mechanisms and
motion capture systems.
Yeah, well, both consumer side devices like chairs that you can sit in that rumble, you know, awesome stuff like that. And then also things like, you know, I think the Giant Bomb guys have talked to the Speed Tree folks a lot over the years. But a lot of other weird middleware things. And it's where you first saw things like Havoc, the physics simulation people, and the company that NVIDIA bought that did the same thing.
So to be fair, it is still a lot of that. On the show floor, Speed Tree is still there. Havoc is still there. But if you walk in, the big 5 booths are PlayStation, Nintendo, NVIDIA, AMD,
There's an Xbox booth in there and an AMD, and an ARM booth. Well, and the other thing that changed was a lot of the people that were making middleware, the full engine middleware got scooped up by different companies. So like Criterion bought the one of the middleware companies, one of the others, there used to be a bunch of people that made, Unreal style engines, just engine ass engines that you could then pay a license to and use that to do the core parts of your game, so you don't have to build from the ground up. And Unreal has eaten a lot of that and for the third party stuff, and then the other stuff has gone gone internal to the different companies.
If you're a consumer,
yeah,
there's really no reason to go to GDC.
Unless you want to make games.
If you're not someone who makes games and maybe follows a little bit of game development, but just enjoys playing games for the most part, you love E3, but not love GDC.
So the only exception to that is that maybe there's a lot of interesting talks. So, much like I would never don't pay for an expo pass, because you can get just an expo only pass. It's not terribly expensive, I don't think, and that'll get you into the floor. But the interesting thing is in all the talks, and that's where the good stuff happens. Unfortunately, we can't go film in those, so there's not a whole lot for us to do there.
And they're online.
Shortly thereafter, yeah. But that's where you can go see Mike Abrash talk about augmented reality, and where you can go see,
you have a lot of postmortems about games that recently came out and
even old stuff
about their successes and failures and things they've learned. And it's really educational. And even if you're not there as a developer, but if you want to know the backstories of these games, they're good stories.
That stuff's interesting. A lot of it ends up on Gama Sutra over periods of time. You also have it's a real high accessibility event. So like I went over after we finished shooting today, I went over to this board game section where people who make video games for a living have made board games that they just wanted to demo. So it was stuff like The Train and the metagame and some of the other stuff that we've seen before. But then also like Stone LeBrand was just sitting there with his city tile game. So I got to talk to him about that for a little bit. It's a very interesting event. And if you're interested in getting into games, the nice thing is if you want to volunteer, I think for a couple of days or something, then you get basically full access passes. You can go sit in talks the other days, and it's a good way to get in. So if you don't have the $1,500 to buy a ticket and you're interested in learning about games, then you can.
Otherwise, it is pretty expensive. Those free lunches aren't cheap.
Yeah, it's a trade conference, so it is an expensive thing to go to, just like WWDC or Google I.O. or something like that.
So we were only on the show floor, the expo floor, for a few hours today, and the things that we saw were somewhat interesting. We shot a couple videos, one of them should be on the site right now. But one thing we saw was the Oculus Rift.
Yeah, so you saw this at CES. The last time I had seen it was at PAX. Gary saw kind of like a demo in the Four Seasons lobby, I think, at South By a few weeks ago.
And so we did talk a little about this last week, and we got to catch up with
Errata.
Get into that. And we got to catch up with Nate Mitchell, VP of Product there, and Joseph Chen, who was also at the CES, helping with coordinate that meeting. And got some facts straight from the source.
Yeah.
About the Oculus Rift, the truth about how Oculus Rift will work. So let's correct a bunch of things we said last week, and
that possibly informed by
they're informed by both
things that we don't want to talk about.
They're informed by misreadings of not unclear statements made online.
So you're saying by reporting on other people's reporting, we possibly made a mistake.
The mistakes were made.
Okay.
Everything's set straight now.
Here's the truth.
And we'll talk about both Hawken and TF2, because those are the developer showcase games that are launching with the Oculus Rift, which are shipping, the Kickstarter dev kits are shipping end of this week.
This first batch. I think they said they're shipping 1,500 a week or something like that. That may have been in a Kickstarter note. Okay, so they were doing the Hawken demo. Well, first off, the thing we messed up last week.
Well, we'll get to TF2 because we'll do a whole thing on TF2, but the Hawken demo was there.
The Hawken demo was on today. It's the first time I've sat with an Oculus since they had the final-ish hardware. And did he say that was final hardware that we were using today, or
final dev kits?
Okay. It was much more comfortable than the thing that I used at PAX last year. Obviously, that was put together with duct tape and had like a ski goggle strap, and it looked like something that a dude had made in his garage.
3D printed, lens cups.
It was awesome, but definitely a kind of a proof of concept. This was a much more comfortable product. They've added a head strap that goes across the top, right, like you see on some head-mounted lights.
Or GoPro.
The GoPro head mount has one as well.
And the reason for that is because with the new 7-inch LCD panel that they use that was different from the one we put on at CES, it's a little heavier.
Oh, okay. I didn't notice it being a little bit heavier.
We also only played for about 10 minutes each.
I was in for about 10 minutes, which is the longest I've had with it.
So let's start talking about Hawken first.
Yeah, so one of the things to note is that when you do the demo on the show floor, you don't do anything like set your interpupillary distance. You don't adjust the eye cups for maximum comfort. I think they were using all of the, like, this was using the standard AI cups.
A cups.
So I had my glasses underneath. I think you did too.
Yes, so let's explain what those mean.
Yeah.
When you get, if you buy an Oculus Rift developer kit.
Yeah.
And they haven't announced anything about the consumer model, but presumably this will be the consumer model as well.
He strongly implied that there would be a different solution for the consumer.
Okay, so at least for the developer kit, it comes with not only the goggles, but lens cups.
Yeah.
And there are three pairs of lens cups. They label them A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And each has a different focal length.
Mm-hmm.
Or some type of lens correction.
Yeah, so if you're farsighted, it's not a problem.
If you're farsighted, you don't use the normal ones.
This distorts
The image that coming from the LCD. And if you are nearsighted, you can use the B cups or the C cups.
Right.
And those are the
C cups are the best. Norm is frustrated.
Those are increasingly nearsighted. They did not give a prescription valuation for those because they are not doctors, and so they are just closer zoomed.
Stronger
magnification.
So my hunch is that if you have bad vision, you're probably going to want to wear contacts or mesh.
Just wear them over your glasses. You're not supposed to wear them very tight.
Yeah.
And the top strap over the head does help with that. There also is an adjustment inside the goggles to physically move the distance from the lens to your pupils,
which gives you a little more adjustment on the amount of correction.
And the good thing is that both the left and the right eyes can use different lenses if you have an astigmatism.
Yeah,
like I do. But we both put them on over our glasses.
I don't think that's what astigmatism means.
Yes, it is. Astigmatism means if your left and right eye have if one's nearsighted, one's farsighted, or different.
I think it has to do with
What is an astigmatism?
The Wikipedia says an astigmatism is an optical defect in which the vision is blurred due to the inability of the optics of the eye to focus a point object into a sharp focused image on the retina. This may be due to an irregular or conic curvature of the cornea or lens.
If your eyes have different.
No. It's basically you don't have smooth refraction throughout the eye. So one part of your eye is sharper refraction than the other.
They are different. One part of the eye or one eye is different?
One part of the eye is different than the other part of the same eye, is my understanding.
One lens is concave, one lens is convex.
Anyway,
Hawken.
Yeah.
Was the demo we played, and that was the only thing they had on the show floor, mm-hmm. and it was the first cockpit game we played.
Yeah.
Hawken is a game that's out now. It's a mech game. It's a multiplayer mech shooter, and when you play Hawken just with a keyboard and mouse on a regular monitor, you can look around the cockpit by holding on a key. So you can aim with a mouse, or you can look around.
Yeah.
Just like you can with any other, like,
most other virtual cockpit
simulator games. With the Oculus Rift mode, you can look around with your head and then aim with the mouse, aim with the chassis, and then move with the keyboard.
Yeah. So they were doing the demos with the gamepad, specifically because it's easier to, you don't have the kind of flailing around trying to find the home keys and all that stuff.
Most people can use gamepads.
So when you sit down and put the goggles on, I mean, first off, I want to reinforce, it completely fills your field of vision. This is something that you can't overemphasize.
Yes, completely fills your field of vision, but also makes all the details and pixels that much more noticeable.
Well, yeah, it is very pixely. But I kind of found I didn't care very quickly. I think this is a situation where you're going to run the game at a relatively low resolution, because it's what, 1280 by 800 or something like that.
But it renders at 720.
And then what you're going to do is turn up the anti-aliasing to like 32x so that it smooths out all those jaggies. But the experience, okay, so let's explain that. You put the goggles on. The first thing you do is you kind of look left, you look right, you look all the way behind you, you look up and down.
Which in Hawken you can do because you're in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Your feet are not rendered. And they adjusted the UI so that there's no...
You're really obsessed with the feet not being rendered.
That was very weird. It was very weird to look down.
Didn't bother me, really. Mm. Like an empty chair? See an empty chair?
You saw the floor of the back. Your disembodied head.
My legs were really spread apart.
Okay. And in the HUD of the cockpit, of the mech, is where your stats were. So if you look down, you could see how your ammo and energy.
The demo was in God mode, though, so I never ever looked at that stuff.
Right. So it was more of a look down than a glance down. Mm-hmm. But you could look down. I think in that game, like fighting were those AI mechs, because there was no reticle, because it needs to account for Z depth as well. When they didn't implement that for this demo, it was difficult to hit them, hit people, especially if you're looking, if your natural gaze wasn't calibrated.
You basically always had to do a ranging shot.
You had to fire in advance, see where the center shot hit, and then find your enemy and shoot them. So it wasn't as easy. It was definitely fun, but it wasn't as easy to hit someone.
Well, so one of the things when you were doing the demo, I was talking to Nate. And he said that they're actually doing a talk about the challenges of HUD in games that use the virtual reality. Because I have to assume, from talking to him, it seems like this is the case. It's similar to the challenges that you have when you're using shutter glasses. Because you can't put a 2D reticle on a 3D space. It just doesn't work.
You can, but then it looks like it's popped up really outside of the screen or flat on the plane before the depth of the game goes in.
Well, it has to have some logic to understand. Because if it's just centered in the same place like a normal crosshair is, it's not... when your perspective changes, your aim's going to be off.
And also, when you're in the logic of the game, the HUD of the like the front of the mech, the screen, where if that's where your reticle is supposed to be, then it wouldn't make sense for it to pop out and be flat and plain with where other UI data is, menu data is.
Right. So in this case, you might superimpose this reticle on the cockpit of the cockpit glass of the mech, or the other thing he mentioned was mini maps. There's no mini maps in Hawken right now, and figuring out how to present those in a way that makes sense is
because you don't want to have it in the corner of the screen where your eyes are going to be looking in the corner,
right?
And where if you move your head, then it's not going to it might not necessarily still be in that corner.
Yeah. So with shutter glass games, like the NVIDIA 3D stuff and the ATI 3D stuff, what they've done in the past is done things like a laser sight, where you essentially project a dot out from the weapon, or kind of smart reticles where they kind of put a frame almost like in a fighter jet around the target that you're going to hit.
One thing to also emphasize is while this wasn't shutter-based 3D, it was still stereoscopic 3D. Mm-hmm. And that is not that is something you just take for granted when you're playing.
You'd assume.
And I think that if it wasn't stereoscopic, it would be a less immersive experience. But the immersion comes mostly from the one-to-one head tracking.
It's both. It both work together, and the effect is really, really convincing.
Yes. The best part of Hawken, though, was not the firing of weapons and combat, but the flying around.
The flying around, getting up on a really high tower
it's hovering over the city, the map, and looking down and really looking around that map while you're hovering. I mean, that was really, really cool.
Makes me want to play Graw. Remember those huge maps with the... Although that was third person, wasn't it? Was Advanced Warfighter third person or first person? I can't even remember.
That was third person.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know how third person games are going to work
PC
with this.
And Xbox also.
Oh, that's right.
It made me want a helicopter game, some type of VTOL game.
Yeah, or a jetpack game. Like I want to play the Rocketeer game.
Something like that.
So I think I played for a little bit longer than you because you were. I played while you were talking to Nate. After a fairly lengthy period of time, I could feel myself starting to reach the limits of what I wanted to do.
Good point to talk about TF2. Yeah. And here's all the real facts of TF2. We're going to go down because TF2 was the VR mode is developed by Valve.
Yeah.
And there's actually a page on the TF2 Wikia explaining how to get into Oculus Rift. And one of the very first things it says is that you, if you're just getting started, you should not play for more than 10 minutes at a time. You need to get accustomed to the Oculus. And the longer you play, the longer, you know, you get VR legs, and you get to play, you know, for extended sessions, and eventually, hopefully, get comfortable with that simulation. It seems like to launch it in VR mode, you just change the executable and add -VR.
Yeah, you put a command line.
And then that opens a bunch of different command line options in game.
Yeah.
And very specifically, there's 8 modes of control with the Oculus in TF2. On the wiki page, it's split into three or four different sections, and it seems like they're not all very specific. So if you type in, if you bring down the console,
is the thing we messed up last week, just to be clear.
Right. If you bring down the console and you set the mode to 0, this is the mode that we thought would be the only way to control the Oculus Rift, which is moving and aiming are tied to the head, tied to the Oculus.
Yeah.
That is not ideal.
I could see a place where that's ideal. If you wanted to play TF2 with a gamepad, which I do not advocate or think is a good idea, that is probably going to be a better way to do that than trying to aim with your right mouse, with your right,
okay,
right stick. I don't think that's a good idea. I think it's a bad idea, but I'm just saying, if you wanted to play TF2 with a gamepad, there you go.
And then, but if you change the game mode to, instead of 0, to 1, then you are aiming with the Oculus Rift, that is aiming with your head, mm-hmm, and the mouse controls your body, the movement. So your head controls the reticle.
I want to control movement with the buttons, with the keys.
Well, I mean, when I say movement, I mean turning.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think WASD will still do strafing.
Like, this is unclear. I think we have to just see what this... See how this works.
It's not very clear. You're right. It's not very clear on the wiki page. But I think the interpretation of that is that you're aiming with your face, steering with only your mouse. And they said this mode may be buggy and drift after a while.
So the thing that Nate said was that basically there are a multitude of options in TF2.
Well, yeah, and they in correcting us last week, you know, Palmer said there were about 7.
Yeah.
And it looks like only 2 or 3 of those are really the ideal ones.
Well, it seems like there are 5 real ones and then 3 kind of experimental ones. The thing that I want is the ability to aim with the mouse and have limited head movement with the head tracking.
I
can corner the eye, corner, you know.
Well, limit, I mean, you're going to only choose to limit your head movement. Like, you're never going to look around.
Yeah, I can't spin.
Right. That is choice. So modes 2, 3, and 4 are grouped together in this Wikia. And this is, I think, what most people use. They say default mode is mode 3. And to clarify, this is a good thing. There is the dead zone, the mouse aiming dead zone.
Right.
The way that a lot of simulation games like Operation Flashpoint had.
Okay.
In which you move the mouse around, mm-hmm, within a box at the center of your screen. And when you're moving the mouse around in that box, that's where you're aiming to fire. But when you move the mouse to the edge of that boundary, the dead zone,
and you can do fast turns.
So that's to move. That's to turn quickly.
Right.
But you're still using your head to look around. And the good thing also is that there is a command line to change the size of that boundary box.
That is good.
So for a lot of people, if you need to aim on the corner, I mean, if you like really big mouse movements, or if you're a 5800 DPI guy, then you'll tweak that to whatever settings you want. Other interesting things, because Nate mentioned that one of the cool things about using TF2 or the Oculus Rift in TF2 is that you get to look at the character model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now, even in TF2 right now...
Hold on, what do you mean you get to look at your character model?
So you can see you can look down, and if you're the heavy, you can see the
gun. Oh,
the
really? Gun. I thought those character models were just like arms and hands and guns.
Well, Valve had to...
Oh, they filled it out.
They had to change some of that. I think it's really easy to fill that stuff out. It's definitely different from those character models that you're going to see when you are just playing with a normal keyboard and mouse.
Yeah. Because when you look down in a normal game, you just see a shadow on the floor. And your
but you
and
see
your
the hands.
Gun in hands.
You see the gun in hands. So you could see your body, but by default, they don't render to the head.
Well, that makes sense, because I can't. Can you see your head right now?
You cannot see your head right now, but in game, if you're rendering the entire body, so there's a mode for the head to disappear. But for people who really want to see their head, i.e., see their hats,
mm-hmm, you can see like the brim of your hat.
If you're wearing an extra big hat, You can.
I want to get my Devil Wears Pimp hat on.
And the cool thing is, they've compensated for this by actually, and something I didn't think about, moving the model back or moving the vision forward, so it's where the pupils would be in the head model.
Yeah,
it's moving, and you can adjust that as well.
Interesting. So there's a couple of things that are mechanical that they talked about. They talked about knowing your interpupillary distance. Because it is a good thing. That way the render actually happens at the distance apart your eyes would be to give you the right perspective, which is one of the things that apparently causes problems with this kind of stuff. So you can get that from your optometrist. Or there's also a tool in the game that apparently will help you calibrate that stuff. I would ask my optometrist if I were you. Actually, probably your optician is a better guess because they use that machine when they fit your glasses.
The upshot is that with the Oculus Rift, even if once you enable the mode with the command line, you will be doing a lot of tweaking in game.
Command line stuff
to a lot of tweaking to get it set just right for you.
The other thing about the wiki is that they have
can do the tweaking.
They have a whole section that's about that. It basically says, "Hey, you have to take your time because it's going to take a few sessions to adjust." And I can attest to this. After about 8 or 10 minutes playing Hawken, I was ready to take off the goggles and not be in 3D world anymore. The test is going to be if this resolves itself. Part of that was probably because it was a demo machine that hadn't had the pupillary distance set and hadn't had the I had my glasses crammed on under there, and we were on a kind of hot, sweaty show floor.
I still think that this is something that's best suited for a single player game. And that if you're playing, it's just like the old days where if someone turned down graphical settings and you're playing a multiplayer game, then the grass wouldn't render and they would have a competitive advantage because they could see you and you can see them. And while you would technically be enjoying a higher fidelity game with all the graphics turned up, you would maybe not see someone as quickly as they saw you.
Yeah.
If you're wearing the Oculus Rift, you're going to have a great immersive experience, but at the expense of being able to play the game maybe as well as someone else who's playing it on keyboard and mouse. And
Unless the ability to twist your head independent of your aim. I mean, if you're playing TF2 and you're shooting at someone and you're a heavy, you can keep shooting at someone and look over your shoulder to see if a spy is coming up on you.
Absolutely,
and that's a real thing. The other thing that was interesting about this is it's the first time I've done the demo with glasses, and I was really. It is a relatively low resolution screen, and because of the way they render and because of the way the lens system works, it splits the vertical resolution, the horizontal resolution, in half. So you essentially are viewing half a viewport, rendering half a viewport in front of each lens.
You're getting 640 pixels width for each eye by 720 tall.
It seems like, though, the kind of the brain stuff that Ray Sonora had talked about, filling in the gap, how your brain essentially fills in the gaps for you when you're using, say, passive versus active shutter 3D glasses, seems to apply here as well. I didn't feel like I was seeing reduced resolution or a narrower field of vision or anything like that. I felt like I was seeing a massive, massive, huge field of vision as I was playing these games.
Yeah.
The upshot is when you start out, you want to play a few 10-minute sessions, make sure you calibrate it. And the TF2 people are recommending that you start with slow classes rather than fast classes. So probably you are not going to get into the scout right out of the gate, and maybe not the pyro either.
And we are crossing our fingers and hoping that our Oculus Rift will be in next week, and we'll do many.
I think we should do a marathon. I think we should see how long we can play. I think we should live stream that.
We had two Oculus Rifts.
I know someone who has an Oculus Rift coming.
I bet we could get our friend who has an Oculus Rift to come in and do a deathmatch setup right here. Oculus Rift versus Oculus
Rift. Rift versus Rift. It's going to be real hard to show, though, because we'll have I guess we do one half of each screen and stretch it out.
Joey will figure it out.
Joey is a wizard. Okay, so that's it on Oculus. It seems like the Hawken stuff is close to done. The lack of HUD and lack of aiming reticle needs work, obviously, still.
Again, this is just a developer showcase. This is not for it's not for consumers, quote unquote.
It's to show you how this works in a real game, rather, if you are building games,
to give you an idea of where to start.
Yeah, we also talked about the SDK as it pertains to non-game applications, and Oculus is definitely open to that. They are clearly building to support UDK, the Unreal Development Kit, Unity, and a handful of other platforms.
Yep.
Sony, while we were doing the Oculus demo, Sony had a panel at GDC about the PS4.
Many more details about the PS4.
Many more details, but they are, together it's an interesting story. On their own, each of them are relatively small details, I think. However, there's some good stuff. The DualShock 4 will charge in standby. There's a lot of DualShock information, actually, out of this. That's a good thing, because I don't know about you, but I have a really hard time keeping my PS3 controllers charged. They've replaced the analog. So I didn't know this, but apparently the DualShock 3 and the 6-axis had analog face buttons.
The D buttons and yes.
What I thought would have been, the
D-pad,
the circle, square, triangle, and X, I guess. The original Xbox had that, as I recall. And it has to do, measures the force of your impact, right? That's the only reason you do that. I don't know. Have you ever said, I don't know that I've ever played a game that actually uses that, aside from that Extreme Beach Volleyball game for the original Xbox. They're digital now. The digital face buttons are digital, which means
increased latency.
Yeah, a lower latency on the buttons, which is probably good for people who play fighting games, if I had to guess. They're the ones who are going to be excited. They've made the haptic feedback, the vibration motors, analog instead of digital. So previously, if you wanted to get kind of, you had two rumble settings, I guess. And
one end motor or two motors.
Well, and then you could filter, you could turn them on and off at a high speed to simulate in-betweens. The sticks, the analog sticks, have a reduced dead zone, which is interesting. So that means that they'll be a little tighter, and I assume that you can adjust that in the SDK if you want to not have people flailing around. And then the last thing about the controller is that the touchpad has 2 points of sensitivity. So it's a multi-touch controller, but it is not like a
relatively
10-point.
High resolution.
Really?
As well, I think it's like 1280x900 or something.
For something so small, yeah.
2-inch, yeah.
So I assume that's something you're going to kind of reach up and hit mash with your thumbs, is it? Yeah. Or maybe with one finger while your hand's on the left side or the right side.
Swiping.
A couple of other things. They actually came out and specifically said that they're going to record, the console will constantly be recording the last few minutes of footage. Didn't specify an amount of time, but that aligns with the idea that you'll be able to, something awesome happen, you'll be able to hit a button and blast it up to whatever service that they are connected to. Yeah. And then that they'll use both your PSN ID handle and real name for people who you're friends with on Facebook. So, and it seems like it's unclear whether that stuff's going to be opt-in or not, or whether it's universal. I have to assume that they're going to let people who don't have Facebook accounts play games. So I would assume that means it'll be opt-in. That's kind of it.
Yeah, some more details about the camera, higher resolution cameras,
the depth camera,
and the cool thing about the cameras is that they can increase their refresh rate by lowering the resolution, so you can go from 60 hertz to 120 hertz.
Oh, so that's normal for digital camera sensors. It's just whether they turn it on in software or not. It's just like the FS700. Flipboard yesterday rolled out their 2.0 version. I like Flipboard a lot. I don't know if you use Flipboard still, Norm.
I do not.
But basically, it is a social news reader. You can plug in everything from, well, the
soon it turns to be your defunct. RSS feeds into magazines.
Yeah, well, RSS feeds, social media feeds. You hook it into Facebook and Google Reader and Instagram Instapaper, Instagram, Flickr, YouTube, all of that stuff, and it pulls, kind of aggregates all of the accounts that you have on different services into one giant magazine kind of format. It's what I used to read news on Sunday morning. I drink coffee. But not that I get to read news on Sunday morning anymore. But in the old days, when I read news on Sunday morning, it's the way I read news on Sunday morning.
It's a very pretty looking application.
It is nice. It's a good way to kind of do an undirected browse through a lot of content. And the thing that I like about it is it pulls the things that people post on Twitter and Facebook and Google+ that have links embedded out and kind of gives you an Instapaper-like format for that.
Tweeted a link to a Imgur link.
Yeah,
then
that picture just shows up.
It would it would blow that up in a Flipboard as a big splash image.
It could be a cover image. If somebody tweets a YouTube link or a Vimeo link, then that video will just be embedded in the page and you can mash play and it's right there. The thing that they've added with this 2.0 release is really interesting. It's kind of one of those ideas that I'm surprised somebody hasn't thought of before. But basically, it's a way for you to say, hey, here's a feed of stuff that I read and liked, and you can subscribe to people's magazine feeds, essentially, in Flipboard. So, you know, instead of following Maria Popova or somebody like that on Twitter, then you can just click all and see the stuff that she has recommended to Flipboard. They rolled out a bookmarklet to make it easy to submit that stuff, similar to the Instapaper or Pocket or, you know, any of the other bookmarklets that support that mm-hmm. stuff. And it's really clever. It's something like I use Instapaper to read stuff later as a general rule now, but this adds value to that thing that I'm already doing. If I'm somebody who uses a service like Instapaper,
combine those bookmarklets.
It would be awesome if you could, but I don't think so because they're weird JavaScript and they would probably pop up.
I'm sure you can.
Like they both pop up different things. Somebody needs to do is make a bookmarklet that does both at the same time.
I'm sure that exists.
The Flipboard bookmarklet requires a little bit of additional work from you to post it. You have to tell it which of the magazines you want to add it to and if you want to put a comment or something like that on. It's kind of neat. I highly recommend everybody check it out. And I think Flipboard's free, so there's nothing to lose if you have an iPad. It's Flipboard 2.0 is only out for iPhone and iPad so far, but the Android version is coming later this week, they said. T-Mobile.
I think this is probably the biggest news this week.
In terms of
technology.
There is the Windows 8 apps got updated today story. That's next. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But yeah, T-Mobile had a big event this week. They basically have said, hey, look, we're changing the way we do business. And their CEO got on stage and cursed a lot, it sounds like. And basically said that subsidy phones are bullshit, which is something that everyone who understands how subsidized phones work have said for a long time. People don't understand them, and they're saying, look.
Well, people are stupid.
Well, people are uninformed.
I don't know about uninformed. People are easily swayed by pricing schemes.
Shiny things.
It's everywhere.
It's the now versus later thing, right?
No, it's not. Just now. It's you know, it gives people the option that looks more attractive because it has a 9 at the end. Or
Saying it's a simple psychology person. And
yeah,
and
it's nonsense. Like 100% psychology.
Okay, so what T-Mobile is saying is that basically they're going to remove the subsidized phones. So you no longer will you go in and pay $99 or $50 to get a phone free.
Quote unquote free.
That requires you to take a 2-year contract.
Yeah. So it's not saying that they don't have any contract plans anymore. It's saying that now they have
contract
free plans.
This is an option for people who want it. So the way the pricing works on the phones then is that you can pay full price for the phone, get an unlocked phone just like you normally would, which I think is actually a really progressive thing. It's a good thing to do. Yeah.
I think people. Increasingly, as we think of phones as computers, you should think of buying a phone like buying a laptop.
Yeah.
Do you buy a laptop once every year? No. You buy one, and then when it breaks on you, or you know the battery life really dies, or
when something substantially better comes out.
Substantially better, and you've maximized the use of your existing laptop, then you buy a new one.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Most people don't buy laptops, you know, once every 5 years.
3 to 5 years is the average.
Is very spendy, I think, already.
It depends on what price range you're in.
Sure. Phones, I think, should be seen the same way.
I think we're moving toward that.
Good.
This is a step in the right direction.
Good. I mean, if you're paying $600, $700 for a phone, when you buy a phone, you should be aware that is a $700 piece of equipment. You should treat it as such.
So the way the pricing works on phones is that you can either pay the full unsubsidized price or...
Which is in the 700 for modern...
Depends on the phone.
The top-of-line LTE phones, whether from Samsung, HTC, or Apple, around $700.
The Nexus 4 is the crazy low end of that. If it's not an LTE phone, obviously.
Correct. That's $300.
But yeah, your iPhone's off contract. iPhone 5, 16-gigabyte cheap iPhone 5 price is $650. The iPhone 4's off contract price is still something kind of ridiculous, too. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. if you want to not pay $600 for your phone off contract
from T-Mobile,
then what you can do is pay $99 up front for an iPhone 5, which, by the way, T-Mobile now has. This is kind of a big deal, too. And then you'll pay $20 a month for 2 years for a total cost of $580 for the phone.
Great price.
Which is a $70 less than the off-contract price. And
you know, if you have the option to pay it all off at once, whenever you get that money, then... Or, you know,
why would you not pay the $20 a month if they're not charging financing or anything? I mean, there's no downside to
because
paying.
if you want the next iPhone and you want to sell, you can sell the current iPhone for the remainder of that price.
That is true. I think that this is a really good thing. The benefit of this is that you don't pay for the subsidy once you're, if you are, I mean, we have friends who buy phones every 3 or 4 years. If you're buying a subsidized phone and you don't upgrade every 2 years when your contract's due, then you're basically losing money. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're giving Verizon free money or AT&T free money.
You could get the iPhone 5 from T-Mobile, and then we're using that as the example. Pay $99 up front, pay your $20 a month, but if, you know, a year later, there is another cheap Nexus off contract that's $300. You could sell the iPhone, pay it off, and then buy the Nexus.
Yeah,
and switch carriers or do whatever. So let's talk about the plan specifically.
Okay, the data plan.
Well, the plan started at $50.
Okay, for everything.
For unlimited talk and text.
Okay,
including the new HD voice. So this is from what people have used it say it's better cellular voice.
So it's like wideband audio, basically? Is that the idea?
I'm not exactly sure.
It's not the LTE.
It's not in the phones. It's got to be in the back end.
Well, it's both. It's basically they're using different audio compression to produce better quality audio on the phone rather than using shitty old GSM.
If it works, it's codecs, a good thing. Yeah. But for $50 a month, you get 500 megs of data.
So that's a pretty thin plan.
But the good thing... And some people can live off that.
That's true.
That's still better than the 250 or 200 megs, the very basic plans that some carriers have.
Mm-hmm.
If you go over 500 gigs or 500 megabytes a month,
they come to your house and break your legs.
No overages.
Oh, that's nice. They just turn you off.
They just clock you down to 2G speeds.
Oh, that's awesome. That is a really. I mean, 2G, 3 speeds are pretty grim, but that is a nice way to handle the situation.
And the $50 a month, that includes access to now T-Mobile's new LTE network, which they launched in 7 cities. The list is online. I believe it is like D.C., Houston.
It's big cities.
Not San Francisco Bay Area, though.
They're rolling out more over the next
year.
Obviously,
the big issue, though, was... spectrum. It's always about spectrum.
Yeah.
So T-Mobile has always been different from AT&T as a GSM carrier in that it operated on the 1700 megahertz and 21 megahertz.
That's why your 3G iPhone 4 wouldn't work on T-Mobile
because
as a 3G phone, right?
The iPhone 4 and the 4S and all the 3G iPhones, 3G all the way to 4S, the radios in those worked on the 850, 900, 950 spectrums, megahertz spectrums. 1900. And so even if you unlocked your iPhone 3GS and you put a T-Mobile SIM card in it, you'd only get edge speeds because T-Mobile didn't have the 1900 megahertz 3G.
Right.
T-Mobile does now. 1900 megahertz, which was previously allocated for their 2G edge network, is now slowly being moved to HSPA Plus, and they're using their 1700 megahertz for LTE, which... If you have an existing iPhone, so if your iPhone 5 and my iPhone 5, if we unlocked our iPhone 5s, we would not get access to T-Mobile's LTE.
My iPhone 5 is a Verizon iPhone 5.
It's all the same radios.
Okay.
I think you have to pay to unlock it. T-Mobile and AT&T now, though, starting April 12th, will sell a variant of, will all be updated to be unlocked in firmware so it can access 1700 megahertz.
Oh, even the AT&T, if you buy an unlocked AT&T phone.
If you pay full price, $650 to $850 buck iPhone 5 from AT&T, unlocked,
okay,
you can use it on T-Mobile and get LTE access.
This is a good thing for T-Mobile. I mean, this is what T-Mobile needs to do to come out and aggressively go after Verizon and AT&T. Because I think a lot of people don't understand that when they get a free phone, the phone's not really free.
And $50 a month is very reasonable. It's half of what I'm paying. It's exactly what someone who texts a lot
needs. Well, no. I mean, my Verizon family share thing is data plan plus $40 a line.
There's an off contract family plan as well.
Yeah,
for T-Mobile.
Okay.
If you want to, I think if you want to get 2 gigs, 2 or 5 gigs a month, I want to say 2 gigs, you add extra $10.
Well, that's
and if you want unlimited, then it's add $20. So
$60 a month is perfectly reasonable.
$70 a month for unlimited.
Yeah, that's great.
No throttling.
Good for them. I'll be interested to see if this impacts them. They're a little late with the iPhone 5, but hopefully this means that there'll be a day zero iPhone 5S or 6 or whatever the next phone is carrier, which means that basically all the major carriers in the United States have the iPhone now, finally.
All the big four.
6 years in. 6 years in? 7 years in. 6 years in.
6 years
in. 5.5. Do you want to talk about Windows 8 apps?
Sure. Windows 8 updated, Windows or Microsoft updated a few of the core Windows 8 apps for RT.
Yeah, over the last week.
x86, including Mail, People, and Calendar.
And also last week, I think Music, Games, and Video were updated. Have you used a Windows 8 Metro app in the last month?
Not since I returned the Lenovo.
Do you have Windows 8 on your home PC?
No, I put Windows 7 back on it.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I haven't bothered yet.
I cannot do the start menu.
The no start menu.
I can't do the start screen as a shortcuts. I need to be able to hit the start menu and still see my desktop.
Yeah, it's when every time I click on a link or download an image and click on it and it launches in that fucking Metro picture viewer, I just want to reach through the internet and strangle someone.
New features built into the Mail app include the ability to search server.
Great.
Mark sort by unread.
Stuff that makes the app usable?
Things that people, you would come to, that you think would be in a desktop.
Can you drag a mail message into a folder? No.
It is still much built into the Metro.
Can you drag a picture into a mail message? Wait, no, you can't do that. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't want to talk about this anymore. People are just going to get really pissed off at me. They've changed it. They've updated it. They're still not very good by all reports, but they are improved. So there we go. Long version short. Long talk short. I think I'm going to put Windows 7 back on my PC when I have free time. Read never.
But if you're a Windows 8 user, you can look forward to Windows 8 Blue, which is minor updates to Windows 8.
This is like the porn version of Windows 8?
No.
Yeah, you used to say when you started getting filthy, you would go blue. Norm, are you working blue? If you're a comedian and you
What is the definition of and derivation of that phrase?
I don't know. I assume it has something to do with lights. Maybe I don't know.
Anyone from another team? Nope.
I guess I get the default.
3 points. Windows 8 Blue adds some features such as smaller tiles.
Great.
Different size tile options.
I was just thinking, if only the tiles could get smaller.
Start screen color options.
Oh.
It
looks like they're leaning heavily on purple.
Increasing the number of control panel options in the Windows start screen control panel. And deeper SkyDrive integration. I mean, it's iterative improvement. Service Pack 1.
Keep on iterating, guys. Keep on. Yeah, Wikipedia doesn't say what the derivation of working blue is. But Lenny Bruce was the first comedian to openly work blue. That was popular, apparently. Build?
We will find out more about this stuff before or around time of Build.
Yeah, the blue release. I'm not going to find out more about the mail updates because I'm just not going to continue not using that.
So Microsoft is holding its annual developer conference.
Yeah,
so Build. This is the equivalent to Apple's WWDC, Google I/O, and Facebook
Connect.
Facebook Connect, is that the name?
Facebook Adventure. Facebook Extreme. I'm not
sure. One of those.
Facebook Envelop. Absorb.
The name of these conferences are all pretty poorly designed. I mean,
remember
everyone takes a claim. So
we're going to build stuff. We're going to have stuff come in and out. We're going to have a WWDC. It's for worldwide developers. Remember when the DirectX conference used to be called Meltdown? That was a cool name. Because it was about going someplace and it was going to be as cool as a nuclear reactor meltdown, which it turns out isn't particularly cool.
There's also a Salesforce one too.
I think Salesforce is Dreamforce.
Dreamforce, the name of their conference?
Yeah.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. It's because it's where your dreams are forced upon you.
Yeah. Microsoft's is Build, and it's going to be in San Francisco.
I think Build is the least bad of all of them. It's a little on the nose, I guess. Yeah, it's in San Francisco this year, because I assume they want people to come instead of having it in Seattle or something. It's in June. We'll go, because it's around the corner.
End of June, which it's an interesting time, since last year they had it in the fall.
Well, the developer conferences for Microsoft and Apple seem, I guess the Apple one is always in June, but the Microsoft one has always been timed for a specific release.
Product release?
Yeah, so like they did the one where they announced Windows 8 basically 18 months out from their release window, 6 months before they wanted to release the beta. So, I mean, that's when on these in-between ones where I assume we might see the first hint of Windows 9 at this one, because we're almost, by that point we'll be 9 months into Windows 8. And if they're going to be on an 18-month cycle and they need to, or 2-year cycle, and they need to have it out, you know, have something to show in June. I don't know. Apple rolled out 2-step authentication last week.
I still have not turned it on.
They want me to, my password does not meet their new security profiles, and since I have to type it in all the damn time, I'm hesitant to.
They evaluate the strength of your password.
They evaluate the strength of your password, and they found mine not.
They give you a happy face if it's good.
No, it just says you can't turn on 2-factor authentication until you make your password more awesome.
Stronger.
Yeah, which is kind of bunk, because like the whole point of having 2-factor authentication is they can't log in as me unless they have my phone. Like, I think,
or that, something else to verify that to you.
Well, in this case, it's your phone. You have to use Find My iPhone. Find My iPhone will generate the code. I installed the Google Authenticator the other day on my iPhone rather than getting text messages from Google for 2-factor.
I've used Google Authenticator. It's always a fun thing on the phone to rush while the clock ticks down.
Yeah, I like getting the text better.
I don't like getting the text.
I mean, I got tired of paying for text. So, I mean, I have unlimited text, so I guess I don't know why I was annoyed, but... Anyway, yeah, Google Auth, it's fine. It's a 2-step auth. You can only put it on one device, though, which is a little bit of a bummer, because I frequently use my iPad, don't have my iPhone, when it would be nice to have that. If I'd be interested to see if you can kind of give granular control over that. Like, I have 2-factor auth on my bank accounts, but it doesn't trigger to just log in and look at balances and look at statements and stuff like that. It only triggers when I try to transfer money or pay bills or something like that, something that involves transferring actual funds rather than just collecting data, which is nice because it means I can use things like Mint. I hope that there's that level of granularity on the Apple stuff as well. The FAA is exploring relaxing electronics requirements on planes. This has been Nick Bilton's quest for the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and they've set up a committee last year to explore this, and the committee results, the findings have not been released yet, but insider sources tell Nick Bilton that the recommendations will be to be more lax on reading devices, such as
not Kindles, phones.
Definitely not phones, but iPads and Kindles.
That's brilliant. Why not?
And also to have a better definition of the airplane mode.
Oh, so there will be a specific
airplane mode to have a standard setting for what airplane mode is.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that came out of this is that like the goals from the committee, or at least as leaked to Nick Bilton, were that they didn't want the flight attendants to have to be, you know, socially technically aware of what's what. So they want to have a flat series of rules that are easily applied and and make sense to everyone.
Because if you're wearing headphones, they won't bother you on an airplane.
Well, they do if you have your phone out.
That's why you just don't have your phone out. If you're wearing headphones, all you do is block that little hole in the side of your armrest.
Yeah.
And they assume that it's plugged in there. And then the phone can stay on.
But I don't want to listen to the... you shouldn't leave your phone on the plane. Let's go ahead and say right now, leaving something on with an active radio is probably not
intended. Well, you can have an airplane mode.
Okay, fair enough. The point is, if I can't have it out and look at the screen, I'm much less interested in it as a device. I mean, I guess I could be listening to music or a podcast or something.
That's exactly what you do,
right? But I want to sit and read. I like to read on the airplane. That's one of the places that I go to read. So, not having to put the Kindle up always makes me sad, and it's the one place that paper magazines have my undivided attention is the 10 minutes from takeoff to 10,000 feet. There was a good 20 minute, like what was 17, 20 minute, something like that, documentary about the guy that's been 3D printing.
His name is Cody Wilson.
Guns.
And he's in Austin. And yeah. The company is Distributed
Defense.
I think it's, yeah. And Vice went to visit him and produces really, Vice's really.
Vice's Motherboard, I think, actually.
Motherboard is their sub-brand for these tech videos. To give an overview of what is the deal with 3D printing guns. We've talked loosely about 3D printing guns, but this gives a really up-to-date look at where Distributed Defense is.
So people ask us about this a lot because we talk about 3D printing a lot. I initially kind of dismissed it because I was like, well, when they say they're 3D printing guns, they're 3D printing the part that the ATF considers the gun.
The receiver.
The lower receiver.
Lower receiver.
So this is the part that the trigger comes out of and the magazine typically goes into. I don't know if that can change.
Yes.
But it's the part that holds the other bits and pieces together. It is not...
Why from a gun manufacturing standpoint, is that the... is that the part that's regulated?
I haven't any idea. I assume
because he says that because that's the part that serial numbers are attached to. Yeah. You could basically buy at least with something like an AR-15.
That is absolutely true.
Every other component,
yeah,
of the gun except for that one piece.
Yeah, you have to. That is the part that's licensed as a weapon, and the rest of it you can just order over the internet.
And
I don't think Amazon sells it, but okay, there are places like that. I assume that that's arbitrary. It may be because that was a part that was more technically difficult to make 50 years ago. It could also be because it's the part that is kind of holds the other pieces. It's the part that you put all the other pieces into.
So Distributed Defense...
I assume it's arbitrary. Right,
started off by designing a lower receiver to make with a 3D printer. Not something like a MakerBot.
Yeah.
It's a more... high-end industrial 3D printer.
Something that produces something a little more
I believe it's SLS.
Yeah.
It's not multi-plastic.
They showed a couple of different machines. I don't know. I recognized one of them as an SLS machine. I don't know what the other one was.
Yeah. Like a Form 1 Form Labs printer.
No, that's different. The Form Labs is an ultraviolet.
We're talking about something that still raises...
From pellets, though.
Okay.
The SLS is like what Shapeways uses. It has a bed of pellets and a laser comes underneath and that fuses the what is in pellet into. But then they also did pour something in that was very clearly a solvent based thing, a photolithography. So anyway, the upshot is it is a design that you can download and print on a 3D printer, assuming you can get to certain tolerances and you're using a process.
And it designed it in a way to be reinforced. Right. So
there's a few things. Hold on. There's a few things that are interesting about the lower receiver. One is that if it fails, you're not likely to die. So on a if you're shooting a gun and say the barrel, there's a failure in the barrel that causes blowback or something like that. You can blow the firing pin out of the back. You can do all sorts of bad things that will hurt you. Like that can be very, very bad for whoever's holding the gun.
But busting the lower receiver,
it just means that the gun stops shooting.
Okay.
Or it stops feeding rounds into the chamber or whatever. It looked,
And that's important to mention because in their 3D printed lower receivers, all of them break at some point. They're not meant to be...
On a long enough... When the number of shots is incrementing, the lifespan is decreasing.
Yes. And they have successfully, at least they say, and in some of their YouTube videos, produce a lower receiver that can fire 100 shots.
300 was what it said at the end.
300 shots
Before breaking.
Very reinforced.
It looked a little hinky regardless. The point about this is
is that it doesn't matter that if you regulate guns,
eventually...
Regulation of guns is pointless.
So the Vice video is a little politicized as they tend to. He seems to be a guy who read Cryptonomicon and took the bits about giving everyone equal access to guns. Maybe a little I think Nick Bilton said with the verve of a 24-year-old. Taking the politics stuff out of it entirely, which I know is hard to do with guns right now because of a bunch of bad stuff that's happened. It's interesting from a technical standpoint because it is there's a very specific set of forces that hit at a couple of specific places, and the typical milled designs, because the typical way you'd make a lower receiver is that you'd either be a machinist and make it on a vertical mill.
Which people have done.
Which is easy to do. Yep. If you have those skills, mm-hmm. or
you would plug a 3D file into like a Tormach, a big CNC mill, and just let it go nuts and come back 2 hours later, and there'd be a lower receiver there. The difference is that the metal has a different physical characteristics and responds to stresses differently, so that the plastic in the 3D printed receivers, so they behave differently and they require a different set of design challenges. And they've had to change the design 3 or 4 times to get something that fires a couple hundred shots.
Well, what's more interesting, though, is that now it seems like they're moving away from receivers and moving to magazines.
Yeah.
And high-capacity magazines, which is something that, from a lawmaker perspective, is easy to regulate. But then if that's also something that's easy for someone to make on their own, then the regulation becomes much less useful.
Yeah, because a magazine is essentially just a box with a plate in the bottom and a spring that pushes the plate up.
Yeah.
So all it has to do is fit into the right slot, right, feed the bullet in the right place, and push up. And be able to withstand the force of the spring. So I initially dismissed this because he is definitely printing guns from the legal sense, from the legal sense of what it means to print a gun. If you ask the ATF, then they say, yes, this guy is printing guns
he has a license to manufacture firearms. It's
perfectly legal. In the context of, I can download some stuff from the internet and then have a gun, that is not true.
That is even further away from, I can download some stuff from the internet and have a doll chair for my daughter.
Yeah, that's a dramatic. It's dramatic. It's not just far away. It's off in the horizon beyond.
And that is even something that's not easy today.
It's not possible today. The design, printing a gun barrel that's going to last is not something you can do with plastic, or at least not that's going to fire more than 1 or 2 rounds. And be super duper dangerous. Building a firing pin and a breech mechanism is not that. The 3D printing just doesn't work for that stuff. It's not fine enough tolerances. There's too much friction, and it's going to do bad things if you try to do that. What he's saying is, if you have a barrel and you have a stock and you have an upper receiver and you have magazines and you have the other stuff that comes with a gun, then you can take this piece of plastic, connect all that stuff to that, and have something that'll shoot 30 or 40 times. And what's going to happen is the regulation on the sale of the other parts is going to change as a result, which is probably not his intended outcome. That's the takeaway on 3D printed guns, I guess. It was an interesting piece. I think everybody should watch it.
Yeah.
Whether you are pro or anti-gun, it is worth the 20 minutes it takes to watch. They also had a really good thing about the superconducting supercollider a few weeks ago that I found as a result of watching this video. So
it totally seems like one of those arguments in those pedantic arguments on the internet.
It is a pedantic argument, like whether or not he's printing guns.
Right.
It is like I said, it's interesting from a legal standpoint. It's interesting from a technical standpoint. It is not necessarily of concern from a gun control standpoint for the time being. And it may be, I don't know anything about this, it may be that there's enough barrels and other bits and pieces of guns out there that like at this point regulating that stuff is a complete waste of time. Things are changing as a result of 3D printers. There's another new Netflix show that I saw got introduced this morning, Sense8.
It is a science fiction show.
I like science fiction.
Netflix looks to what people like.
Yeah.
And what people watch a lot of, and they're trying to kind of fill in all their gaps. So they have comedy, sitcom, mm-hmm. People who watch love 30 Rock and love The Office.
Dramas.
Typically love Arrested Development.
Yeah.
And that is the confluence of all those likes. Political dramas, you have House of Cards, and they have some other show. I forget the name of the show, but there's some other comedy show also.
They have a couple of reality. They have a reality thing too, don't they?
I'm not sure about that. But they announced today their next show is going to be Sense8, which is a show produced by the Wachowski brothers.
Oh,
and not what
you mean the Wachowskis.
The Wachowski siblings.
Yes,
and that will debut next year. Production.
You've watched all of House of Cards, right?
Yes.
Yes. What are your top 3 categories on Netflix? Like when you go in, what are the ones, if you go into one of the apps that sorts by, well, hold on. Does everybody in your house use your Netflix account?
My Netflix account.
So that it's science fiction, comedy, and drama.
It's mostly comedy.
Okay.
It's mostly because people use it to watch 30 minutes of something silly.
Well, it's easy to get consensus, I would think, on, hey, let's watch 30 Rock or Parks and Rec or Community.
Yeah, I think it's like more that. Like, you know, people when they're eating dinner, they want to watch something that's 20 minutes and not commit to a full hour.
That full 43 minutes.
Or 2 hours, you know, an hour and a half for a movie.
Well, and the other thing with dramas, at least Gene and I have found, is that stuff's so serialized now, it's hard to drop in and drop out. Like, if we're going to watch a drama together, if we're going to watch, when I started watching Downton Abbey, it screwed up her entire schedule because it meant that she then has to wait for me to watch new episodes, because if you miss an episode, then, you know, the whole thing falls apart. Same thing for Mad Men and
that's
Breaking Bad.
One of the many reasons that there are fewer serialized dramas on television right now, but the best shows are still the serialized dramas.
That's true. I think that does it for news this week. Did we miss it? I think we hit everything. I would highly encourage everybody to turn on two-factor if you're an Apple user, especially if you have the ability to wipe your devices tied to that. They had another security breach last week. There was a huge DDoS attack on internet infrastructure stuff this morning. Details about that are still coming out. It seems to be related to some anti-spam tools. So we're not going to talk about that. If there's more information next week and it turns out to be interesting, we'll probably talk about it then. Anything else, Norm? I think that's it. I'm going to play some music and we'll talk about what we've been testing. Norman Chan, You've spent some more time with the Roku 3.
Yeah, something I didn't mention last week that has, now that I've thought about it more, is really, really stupid, is that when I set up the Roku 3,
yeah,
I had to put my credit card number in.
You had to?
Had to.
Same thing that when you set up an Apple TV, you have to put your credit card number in.
Yes.
Or an Xbox that has apps.
Well, not
but something. You can buy cards. You have to have an Xbox Live Gold account, which means they have to have your credit card, or you have to have bought a card at Target or GameStop.
There are some devices, I guess it's true for the Xbox as well, but you don't think of it that way because you set up the Xbox, you download the Netflix app, and you just log in.
Well, except for that only works if you have a Gold account, though, remember.
So the reason I dislike this,
yes,
because when you set up the Roku, you have to create an account, a Roku account, mm-hmm. which, I mean, if you compare it to the Apple TV, you have to create an Apple TV account.
You probably already have one, though.
But I have one. And to create a Roku account, you need to go to the website and you need to fill out your credit card information just in case you happen to want to make purchases. And the good thing is that it's not so anyone can make purchases with your account. You can attach a PIN
anyone
code.
Anyone on the device?
Not anyone on the device, because you can attach a PIN code to purchases. Okay. So even free programs, you can have the option to require a PIN code, a 4-digit PIN, to download free apps for the Roku, of which there are many.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
local weather stations.
Well, yes, everything but YouTube. If they're going to make you go on the website and create an account and make the website an app, like a usable part of that service, they should allow you to log into all those services on the website.
Oh, instead of having to use the set-top box.
Yes. If I'm going onto Roku.com and creating an account and putting my credit card number in and managing my Roku apps, such as Netflix, Amazon On Demand, and Hulu, in there, I realize that some of those services require me to go to those sites.
But why would
like
you not,
Amazon.
Why would you not just go... Why would you, if you're on a computer, why would you not just go to Amazon and look at your stuff there, or HBO Go?
Because if I'm setting a Roku box up, like another Roku box, if that's all tied to my account, if it's all protected and tied, then why can't I just, you know, associate the Roku box and then?
Oh, you're saying why can't you manage the apps on the website?
Yeah.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. I want to be able to set it all up on Roku.com so that when I turn on the box, log in to one Roku.com account. Everything is logged in.
You don't have to fiddle with
three different ways of logging in.
The requirement for an account with a credit card attached was part of the Roku 2 setup, at least. I think maybe even the Roku 1. I can't remember. So that isn't new, just for what it's worth.
The universal search is really good.
So can you search? And so that means you can search, like if you're at the universal search and you search for Oz, then it gives you both Dr. Oz on your local NBC station app and Oz on the HBO Go app.
No, it only searches a very limited number of apps so far.
Oh, so the developer has to support it?
Including Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu, and Views, and Crackle.
Okay.
HBO Go is searched, but HBO Go is not supported on Comcast.
Oh, it still doesn't work.
Still doesn't work on Comcast. I don't know who exactly is responsible for that. Is that Comcast not allowing Roku, or HBO not allowing Roku on Comcast, or Roku not supporting. I think it's Comcast.
If you have HBO Go on Xbox and Comcast, then it works. Or if you have HBO Go on an iOS device, you can AirPlay to the to the Apple TV.
So that why? Works. So who's responsible?
I guess Roku didn't pay Comcast the extortion money, or HBO Go. I don't know. Somebody needed to pay someone money, and someone didn't do it.
What I don't like about the search, or maybe what I wish the search had more of. So if you search something, you can search a movie name or title or by actor. It doesn't do the IMDb deep thinking thing. So
The thing that the TiVo app does that's really neat, where it looks at what you're watching and says.
Or if I search something like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it gives me Arnold Schwarzenegger and I have a list of movies. I go, okay, he was in Eraser with Vanessa Williams. Maybe I want to watch some of Vanessa Williams' movies. I can't then go in under Eraser and then click Vanessa Williams.
Which you can do on the Apple TV.
I don't know if you can even do it on
the app. Just go to the bottom.
Yeah.
It's like a hidden feature.
See, that's what I would want.
That's actually my favorite part about the TiVo app is if you're watching, like last night I was watching an episode of Seinfeld and there was a guy on that I recognized. I knew I'd seen him in something fairly recently. Couldn't figure out who he was. I launched the TiVo app. It says, oh, you're watching Seinfeld. Here's the main cast of Seinfeld. Here's the guest stars for this episode. And it turns out it was the dad from the Transformers. So I felt kind of sad. And you could watch
a couple other movie things he's been in.
Well, yeah. I mean, whatever. The thing is you click down and it says, okay, this movie is available on Amazon and Netflix. This movie's not available anywhere. This one's on demand. So it takes what you have available and
so related to that is that the search function does not pop up. It is part of the main menu, and you cannot activate it at any time.
Oh, so you have to go all the way out to the home menu.
All the way out.
And what's the launch time like on apps? I know that the Netflix app on my Roku 2 takes a while to launch compared to, say, the Apple TV or
it is acceptable, but it is something that could be faster.
So how much is this? Is it $99?
$99.
So how long do you feel comfortable? I mean, we'll do obviously a video with it soon. But right now, I know people are looking at this and thinking, oh, should I get this? Should I get an Apple TV? Should I get something else? Or should I just pay for gold and use my Xbox? It's
a very, very specific use case. Like if you don't have any of those.
Yeah.
And you only use Netflix.
Or your TV doesn't so have a Netflix app, maybe.
And your TV doesn't have enough. I would say do not buy this if you just need a Netflix
app. Okay.
If you are a heavy Netflix and Amazon user and HBO and you're on Time Warner or not on Comcast, then it is a great box.
Yeah. Fair enough.
More on it later.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. I've been testing my endurance. The baby decided that she likes to wake up about every hour or hour and a half.
Not so good baby anymore.
It's up and down.
You're really proud of that baby being a good sleeper.
The baby has been a great sleeper until the last two nights. I think it's because it's too cold or too hot in the house. Night before last, it was too hot, and last night we made it too cold because we swung too hard the other way. This morning when I was driving in, all I could think was, oh God, I shouldn't be behind the wheel of a car right now.
That's a good place to be.
No, because I was on the freeway. We've both been playing Bioshock Infinite, which we're not going to talk about at all because I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but how far have you?
20% in.
20% in. So you, okay. It's pretty fucking awesome so far. The shooting's a little rough is the only thing I would say. It feels like an old school shooter. I love that they gave enough of the magic juice. They gave you enough mana so that you can actually use powers, which was always my problem with the first game. I never had enough stuff to
ammo management and mana management was always one of those big part of those games.
Well, in the first one, it seemed, to me at least, it was a roadblock. I don't know if they were doing dynamic based on how much you used.
They were not. I don't think they were.
But by the end, it got to the point that I just never had any mana at all, and it was a gun game, which made that not much fun. The second one was much better about that, but yeah, this one is a dramatic improvement at least from where I sit.
It's a good game.
Yeah, people, it's pretty awesome so far. And then you played a board game. That'll be show and tell next week, I guess.
Let's just say that for show and tell.
Okay, so there we go. We won't talk about that at all. Anything else before we roll into? We have a couple questions.
Emails?
Well, but we do the other one.
Emails.
We don't do emails. We do
emails.
No.
Questions.
Boom.
Curtis writes in. We didn't have any good audio questions this week, so I'm reading a couple of questions.
Okay.
Curtis writes in. Hey, tested crew. I'm traveling for work a lot right now, and on my last flight, I had a strange thought about traveling with a laptop, tablet, and phone. We have all experienced the routine of powering down our devices during takeoff and keeping them in a suspended communication mode during the flight. My question to you is, how do you think the FAA and airlines will handle phone peripheral devices like smartwatches, Nike fitness bands, or other new NFC devices, and I presume also the Google glasses? Norman, panelist number one, what are your thoughts?
I don't think the FAA will. I think they'll have a statement on it, but I don't think airline companies will train their the flight attendants to know the difference.
They just now say that you have to turn off your Game Boy or ebook reader. That took like 2 years to happen from the launch of the first Kindle.
The script will change, will be modified slightly.
I would agree with that. I think that although maybe the new regulations come out before any of those devices are really in market, and it's not a problem. Because if you're allowed to use, say, your Kindle in airplane mode, then why would you not be allowed to use your Google Glasses in airplane mode? Same thing. So then what happens is everybody sits down on the plane. They send the last text to their wife before the door closes, and then everybody at once says Google or Glasses, whatever the trigger word is, airplane mode. And then you can't turn it back on because without airplane mode, you have no voice recognition. Jacob wants to know, he has hometown trivia. He says, Swansea, Massachusetts, where I'm from, is where the King Philip's War started. Back when the town was only had 70 settlers in it. We don't really have much more than that now. Okay, well, it's 15,000, but it's a small town. As a senior graphics design student who's in his final semester, I go to a local college and haven't really extended past the tri-state area. I have aspirations of leaving my area to get a job in a large city like Boston, Chicago, or San Francisco. I know Will and Gary are not originally from San Francisco, and that's pretty much it. Could you share your experiences or suggestions leaving small-town America and migrating to a larger city with more opportunities? Thanks, and always be testing, Jake. Yeah, it was really scary.
You anticipate a lot of dirtier people. And sassier people.
The thing I would say is don't be afraid to live with a bunch of people. Like, go find a house with a bunch of people in it, and
that's super scary.
Well, you have a house with a bunch of people in it,
and some of those are small town folk,
right? Have you gotten stabbed or anything yet?
I've thought about stabbing them many times.
Norm has a boarding house in San Francisco. If you're interested in space,
you want to pass the small town test. Get out of your small town before you kill everyone.
Well, there's two types of people, right? There's the type of people that go to college and come back and they're like, I'm going to stay in this small town. I really like it. And then there's the people that...
Well, that was Chicago.
Yeah. That was 4 years is all I could take of this.
Whoa.
No, it's...
I got some stories.
It depends on what
Indianapolis.
You want to do.
My goodness.
Are you talking shit about Indianapolis now? Why do you hate Indianapolis? It's a perfectly I've only been nice there city. Once. When did you go to Indianapolis?
We had a LAN party there.
I remember that. So, moving out of the small town is, there's nothing scary to it. Just figure out a way to come out, figure out where you want to live, figure out a way to make money there.
Tangent.
Yeah.
At the LAN party of Indianapolis, we had a company dinner at the Ruth's Chris Steakhouse.
Ooh, it's good that you had some local color.
And you know what? Downtown Indianapolis was a P.F. Chang's and a Ruth's Chris and Monopoly style big chains. It was a LAN party, so we went with the people and...
The people who are working the show?
Working the show.
Yeah.
Nerds.
Yeah, good nerds. We like those guys.
The Colts had just finished playing a game.
Yeah.
Had won. Oh, and boy. Flew back in and also were hanging out with the Ruth Chris and nobody... I want to say now I want to say nobody. 8 out of 10 people in the group did not know who Peyton Manning was.
Wow, that is some big time nerds. See, I went to the University of Tennessee, so I knew who Peyton Manning was. Yeah. I wasn't there for that one, though. Just figure out a way to make money that's not so you don't end up putting yourself in massive debt when you move someplace, because it's going to be much more expensive than you anticipate. And don't bring your small town salary expectations if you're applying for jobs and stuff, because you will end up fucking yourself beyond all recognition if you take a small town salary in a city like San Francisco or Boston or Chicago.
Call your parents every day.
Call your parents twice a week. Do you call your parents every day?
No.
Right. You live down the street. That'll do it for questions. If you have a question, audio questions are preferred. The email address is podcast@tested.com. Keep them short, under 45 seconds, and make sure you don't sound like you're being drugged behind the Batmobile when you record the question. And I guess that'll do it for us this week. For Norman Chan, anything to plug, Norm? We have as always, a bunch of good stuff on the site. The whale tagging feature the other day was a personal favorite.
Joey and I will be in LA this weekend for WonderCon.
Oh, yeah. What are you doing at WonderCon, Norm?
We are checking out WonderCon, talking to cosplayers.
What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to possibly watching G.I. Joe, which comes out this weekend.
Wow, it's already?
Yep.
Okay. That's a pretty low bar for entertainment at WonderCon. I guess that'll do it for us today. Thank you guys as always. We'll see you next week on another episode of This Is Only a Test. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, today's outro comes from AKH777777. Seven.
There, I didn't see her. Fuck, my hole was not big enough. Oh, I wish I hadn't said that.
I don't even know what you said.
I said, I'm not going to say it again, actually, because it'll sound much better here and you'll be able to use it. It was from a Lantern Run, I believe.
Oh.
What's the weirdest thing you ever saw at GDC?
The weirdest thing I ever saw?
Yeah. Was it the hamster ball?
Probably the hamster ball. There's a good reason the hamster ball was not there and has not been anywhere.
I didn't see the hamster ball. You were there a different day than I was that year. What was the hamster ball? Or maybe we split up.
They were there. It was there in 2010, and it was a giant metal ball that was put onto
like a American Gladiators kind of death ball.
Absolutely, with yes, okay. Yes, chain ball that you would stand in, and they would give you VR goggles and some type of motion control gun, and the ball itself was resting on a platform with wheels on two axes, four sets of wheels that would detect ball motion, and you could walk inside the ball, and that would cause you to walk in the game, the virtual reality game. And the idea, and they had this guy do this whole pitch about this being inside amusement parks and casinos and all that stuff.
It would be like all those VR things that we saw at the Intrepid when we were there on the dock.
What I realized was that if you start walking at more than maybe, I don't know, what's a standard pace?
Like a fast walking speed is 5 miles an hour, 4 or 5 miles an hour.
If you were walking at 3 miles an hour in that ball. Assuming five is a fast walk.
Yeah.
Then you would fall over very quickly.
Because you can't, do you have any peripheral vision at all?
It was bad VR goggles, but more so the problem was momentum with the ball.
Oh, because you couldn't just stop it.
You couldn't just stop it.
It had a lot of mass.
That's why hamsters get caught in their wheels all the time.
I love those videos. It seems like it's really bad for the hamsters, but they're really cute.
Most things that are small and cute are probably suffering all the time.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
It's a pretty grim way to look at life.
Yeah.
Chloe's small and cute. She's not suffering all the time.
She can't stop smiling.
Right. Her face is locked in a permanent smile.
Yeah.
I didn't know we could bring dogs into the office. Mike Horn brought a dog here last week. I would have been bringing Chloe all this time.
You should be bringing Chloe all this time.
I can bring Chloe back to the office.
Now that you can lift things more than 25 pounds.
Yeah, well, she jumps in the car now. We built a little ramp for her.
There you go.
Remember the wave of the Smell-O-Vision stuff? Were you at GDC for the Smell-O-Vision?
We were there for the Smell-O-Vision
stuff. I mean the first wave of Smell-O-Vision, not the second wave. The smell sense. Or
maybe I wasn't there for that.
It looked like a pan flute kind of thing, and it had different scents in each of the pipes on the pan flute. And the idea was that you would load it with cartridges based on the game you were playing. So if you were playing, say, Call of Duty, it would be like cordite and gunpowder and blood, and it would blast out whiffs of the appropriate things at the right times.
Another reason why those companies are no longer around.
You don't think Smell-O-Vision is a good idea? You're standing by this.
I'm not sure it's a marketable idea.
It's the best thing you've ever seen at GDC.
That is a good question. I don't know.
I saw the Miyamoto keynote one year. That was really cool.
just getting to see him. He was an interesting. He was talking about challenges of game design and
seeing John Carmack
and stuff like that
in 2000.
Wow! So like three days.
99, winning an award at GDC. 99.
Was that when they did the Walk of Fame and the Metreon?
Before that.
Okay.
99.
I guess there was no Metreon in 99.
No. Yeah, it was right before it opened. Yeah, that was pretty good.
What was he getting an award for? Doom.
Quake 3.
Or being awesome?
Quake 3.
Really?
Yeah.
Quake 3 was, you know, Quake 3 was a polarizing release. A lot of people didn't like Quake 3.
A lot of people are idiots.
I know. You and I are on the same side on this one. Yeah, I don't know.
You can put on the Vader helmet again.
I'm afraid I'm going to break it. It has a huge crack down the side. So this is on loan from the Adam Savage collection. I can't believe you haven't put the helmet on yet. Why do you not want to be Vader? It has to balance on the headphones just right.
I bet you could stick one of those construction hats in there. Glue.
Well, I think the idea is you put the mask. Here, hand me the mask. It has a fan in there, too. I got to take my headphones off for this.
Oh.
Is that your wire? Jesus. Oh, this is going to be great audio. I'll just cut this part out of the audio podcast. So this is a New Hope helmet, right?
I don't know what's more disturbing, the Vader with just the helmet or just the mask part.
It's really, the lenses are really hard to see out of.
Yeah, just the mask part.
How does the clip work?
Why is it clip-based?
Because it has to stay on somehow. Oh my god, the distortion on the lenses is intense.
Now what you gotta do is
Hold on.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Now if you stay long enough in that pose,
yeah,
then we can use a thumbnail.
Yes, Norman. I would never be able to wear this on a floor.
They're fans.
I couldn't do it. I'm already starting to wig out a little bit. Does it look right? Is it on square?
It looks great.
Really?
I should have walked around like this. Looks wonderful.
Why would I not do this? Let me FaceTime my wife.